Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:32 p.m., 18th of March, 2015. With me today is Senator Geisel, Senator Stoltz, Senator Ellis, and myself, Stedman. Two bills up today for first hearing. We'll be hearing and holding both bills. We'll start with Senate Bill 23 and go on to Senate Bill 55. We can start with Senate Bill 23, sponsored by Senator Ellis. If he could remain in his position here at the committee and tell us what this bill is, and then when his staff support, she's outside the room, will come in and continue on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, State Senator from District J. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we really appreciate you having the bill before us today. Mr. Chairman, fatal drug overdoses have increased more than sixfold in the past three decades and now claim the lives of over 36,000 Americans every year. But specific to this bill is heroin use, and in Alaska, heroin use is here in force. Heroin-related overdoses are claiming more young lives than traffic fatalities, according to the Anchorage Police Department. The 2014 Alaska Troopers Drug Report identified an increase in heroin abuse and the continued use of other opiates as significant concerns. And, Mr. Chairman, those of you who have been here a while know that former Senator Fred Dyson and I have brought this to the attention of the body over the years. The need for more methadone clinic funding, new drugs, the rise in burglaries, there's often a drug component to those, and heroin in particular in my community. This abuse and overdose epidemic is largely driven by addiction to prescription opioids such as OxyContin, oxycodone, Vicodin. And because of the price of these prescription drugs have grown more expensive over time, leading abusers or addicts to seek out a cheaper alternative, and that's generally black tar heroin imported to Alaska by the Mexican drug cartel that brings in other drugs and brings in cheap heroin, which is an alternative for these addicts that became addicted to prescription drugs. The face of heroin is also changing, Mr. Chairman. People tend to think that heroin abuse is a problem plaguing the poor or folks in inner cities, but in the past decade, heroin abuse has exploded all across the United States, and it's hitting the affluent in America's suburbs and rural areas particularly hard. Between 06 and 13, the number of first-time heroin users nearly doubled in the United States from 90,000 to 169,000. With nearly 80% of heroin users saying that they previously abused prescription opioids. That's where it begins. Mr. Chairman, heroin and other opioid abuse has reached epidemic levels right here in Alaska, our concern today. And like the rest of the country, this is not an urban problem. Opioid abuse has reached every corner of our state, literally. A quick internet search turns up stories, but we have a note in our computers in my office to bring up news stories from all across the state. And there's no community that's left unscathed. Drug seizures in Sitka, the Valley, Fairbanks, Bethel, Kodiak, Dillingham, and the list goes on. And as we all know, these highly addictive drugs are also extremely deadly and are killing Alaskans at an alarming rate. This trend is particularly troubling because prescription opioids are very popular among young Alaskans. According to 2011, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 15.8% of Alaska students reported having used prescription pills without a prescription, making them more popular among high school students than alcohol, tobacco, or marijuana. These trends are very disturbing. And luckily, Mr. Chairman, opioid overdose is typically reversible through the timely, and I know our healthcare professionals are aware of this, through the timely administration of the medication naloxone and the provision of emergency care, yet it's often not available where and when it is needed, most because overdose often occurs when the victim is with friends or family members, those people who may be best situated to save the life of the person having the overdose with the administration of naloxone. And currently, without this bill, medical professionals are wary of prescribing. That's what we found out when we started the research on this legislation. Medical professionals are wary of prescribing, and laypersons wary of administering opioid overdose drugs due to potential civil liability. So this is basically a pretty simple Good Samaritan bill. We made some progress last year, and this is the next step. Senate Bill 23 removes civil liability from a doctor who prescribes or a layperson who administers naloxone in cases of opioid overdose. In an attempt to help reverse our opioid overdose epidemic, I hope Alaska will become the 29th state. We're not plowing new ground. We would be adding ourselves to a list of other states who've seen the common sense wisdom of this move. So it's a relatively small bill that could mean the difference between life and death. Oftentimes with our bills we say it's not a life or death situation, but that's exactly what this is. Mr. Chairman, my staffer Amory LaLake has done a lot of detailed work on this legislation, and if it pleases the committee, if she can come forward and walk us through the bill.
It does. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then walk us through the bill and make any other comments, and I'm sure the committee members will have a few questions.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amory LaLake, staff to Senator Johnny Ellis. I'll go through and walk you through the bill line by line and then give you some more detail about the drug naloxone. And we can hear some from folks who would like to testify. So, Mr. Chairman, Section 1 of the bill, page 1, lines 4 through 10, amends AS 965 by adding a new section stating a person is not liable for civil damages for prescribing an overdose drug to a person at risk of experiencing an overdose or to a third party to administer an opioid overdose drug. Subsection A, 1A, lines 11 through 13, states the person prescribing must be a healthcare provider. Subsection A, 1B, page 1, line 14 through page 2, line 1, states the person prescribing naloxone could also be an employee or volunteer of an opioid overdose program. Subsection A, 2, page 2, lines 2 through 5, states the person to whom the opioid overdose drug is prescribed or provided has been educated and trained in proper emergency use and administration of the drug by a healthcare provider or program. Subsection B, page 2, lines 6 through 10, except as provided in subsection C, states a person who administers an opioid overdose drug to another person is not liable for civil damages. Subsection B, 1, page 2, lines 11 and 12, states the person who administers it must be prescribed or provided the opioid overdose drug by a healthcare provider or opioid overdose program. Subsection B, 2, page 2, lines 13 through 15, states the person must receive education and training in the proper emergency use and administration of the opioid overdose drug by the healthcare provider or opioid overdose program. Subsection C, page 2, lines 16 and 17, as an exemption from liability, the exemption from liability does not apply in cases of gross negligence or reckless or intentional misconduct. Subsection D, 1, page 2, lines 19 through 21, just definitions, defines healthcare provider as a licensed physician, advanced nurse practitioner, physician assistant, village health aide, or pharmacist operating within the scope of the healthcare provider's authority. Subsection D, 2, page 2, lines 22 and 23, defines opium, which includes the opium and opiate substances and opium and opiate derivatives listed in AS 1171-140. Subsection D, 3, page 2, lines 24 and 25, opioid overdose drug means a drug that reverses in whole or part of the pharmacological effects of an opioid overdose. Subsection D, 4, page 2, lines 26 through 30, opioid overdose program is defined as a program operated or otherwise funded by the federal government, the state, or a municipality that provides opioid overdose drugs to a person at risk of experiencing an opioid overdose or to a family member, friend, or other person in a position to assist a person at risk of experiencing an overdose.
Okay. Do we have initial questions from the committee members? Okay.
All right. then I'll just continue with a brief presentation. As Senator Ellis stated, states across country have enacted laws to increase access to treatment for opioid overdose as a way to combat increasing opioid overdose rates. Senate Bill 23 provides immunity from civil liability to healthcare providers who prescribe and bystanders who administer opioid overdose drugs, like naloxone, in cases of opioid overdose. Naloxone, also known by the brand name Narcan, is a medication called an opioid antagonist and is used to counter the effects of opioid overdose from drugs like OxyContin, morphine, and heroin. Naloxone is extremely safe and effective at reversing opioid overdose. Specifically, naloxone is used in opioid overdose to counteract life-threatening depression of the central nervous system, allowing an overdose victim to breathe normally. Naloxone is not a controlled substance. It has no abuse potential and has zero effect if administered to someone with no opiates in their system. Naloxone, much like an EpiPen for severe allergic emergencies, comes in the form of nasal spray or is injected in a muscle or vein. The efficacy of naloxone is fundamentally time-dependent, however. Death from overdose typically occurs within 1 to 3 hours, although earlier in some cases, leaving a very brief window of opportunity for intervention. Naloxone takes effect immediately and can last between 30 and 90 minutes. Naloxone is proven both safe and effective. For more than 3 decades, naloxone has been used by emergency medical personnel to reverse overdoses. It is regularly carried by medical first responders and can be administered by ordinary citizens with little or no formal training. Data from recent pilot programs demonstrate that laypersons are consistently successful in safely administering naloxone and reversing opioid overdose. The problem is, Mr. Chairman, friends or family members of overdose victims, not emergency medical personnel, are most often the actual first responders and are best positioned to intervene within an hour of the onset of overdose symptoms. As a result of rising opioid abuse and overdose in 2001, New Mexico became the first state to amend its law to make it easier for medical professionals to prescribe and dispense naloxone without liability concerns, and for lay administrators to use it without fear of legal repercussions. At the urging of organizations including the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the American Medical Association, and the American Public Health Organization, a number of states have addressed this epidemic by removing legal barriers to the timely administration of naloxone. These changes come in 2 general varieties. The first is the approach we take in Senate Bill 23, which encourages the wider prescription and use of naloxone by removing the possibility of negative legal action against prescribers and lay administrators who prescribe the drugs to those who may be able to use it to reverse overdose. So far, 27 states and the District of Columbia have made this important change. The second change encourages bystanders to become good Samaritans by summoning emergency responders without fear of arrest or other negative legal consequences. Thankfully, Mr. Chairman, the legislature wisely took that critical step last year by passing Representative Lance Pruitt's Make the Call Good Samaritan bill, House Bill 369. Alaska is among 21 states to have passed similar legislation in recent years. Based partly on these changes to state law, at least 188 community-based overdose prevention programs now distribute naloxone nationwide. As of 2010, those programs had provided training in naloxone to over 550,000 people, resulting in over 10,000 overdose reversals. A recent evaluation of one such program in Massachusetts, which trained over 2,900 potential overdose bystanders, reported that opioid overdose death rates were significantly reduced in communities in which the program was implemented compared to those in which it was not. Given the safety and effectiveness of naloxone, many public health advocates question why naloxone is not available over the counter. I point this out because its status as a prescription medication does not mean it is difficult or dangerous to use. Italy, for example, has had naloxone available over the counter since the 1980s, without any reported negative consequences. It is understandable that regulators did not foresee the utility of naloxone as a public health intervention carried out by people who are not medical professionals. But in the midst of our current epidemic of accidental deaths related to illicit and prescription opioids, these restrictions are no longer tenable. One very important thing to point out, Mr. Chairman, is that Senate Bill 23 is not a result of a rash of lawsuits over providing or administrating naloxone. I spoke with national experts who told me I would be hard-pressed to find any case law related to issues we address in Senate Bill 23. The bill simply removes an unintended barrier to this life-saving drug. Finally, Senate Bill 23 is not a replacement for substance abuse treatment. We know drug enforcement and rehabilitation are also critical components of this war on addiction. Senate Bill 23 simply gives doctors and bystanders to overdoses the peace of mind that they will not be held civilly liable for doing the right thing. And, perhaps more importantly, gives families and loved ones of addicts a life-saving tool against the heartbreak caused by opioid overdose. Senate Bill 23 is supported by the Alaska State Medical Association, the Alaska Police Department Employees Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center, and countless families and addicts who could not be here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have any initial questions of the bill sponsor? Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and...
Chairman, I just have one real quick.
Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you put your mic in, if you could?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You referenced another statute with, you use the term Good Samaritan. I don't know if that's an apt term. I think the bill that passed was actually it gave grace and mitigation and a free pass for people that were involved in criminal activity. I did object to that as being a Good Samaritan effort. But I think that was a mischaracterization, intentional or unintentional. But as I'm reading this, I just want to make sure, because you referenced the two together, I read this as it appears to be only related to civil immunity. Does it have any expansiveness expressed or intended for criminal immunity?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, some states have...
This statute
only refers to civil liability. I think that the reason that the two are often brought together is that they're both about accessing medical personnel or getting somebody as quick treatment as possible. And often folks did not call 911 because they were worried of criminal charges for possession. So that's why the two are often referenced together.
Mr. Chairman, that's hence my objection to that being called a Good Samaritan, but that might be a singular concern. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Seeing no other initial questions, we'll go ahead and open public hearing. We'll start with you off net. Call on Dr. Paula Colescott. If she's online, she can identify herself, who she represents, and speak to the bill, please.
Yes. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paula Colescott. I'm an addiction specialist that works here at Providence Breakthrough as well as the methadone clinic. And so I've been involved with this population for over 8 years now. Previously worked in the emergency room for over 9 years and now in the outpatient addiction treatment arena. And I can certainly agree with what's been said up to now that we are experiencing an avalanche in opiate use, misuse, and overdose. Unfortunately, the usual story that I hear from my patients who have often witnessed a friend of theirs who has overdosed and died or overdosed themselves tells me that what it usually does is that they grab the individual and drag them into the bathroom and put them in a tub full of cold water trying to resuscitate them. That's the usual method of resuscitation that's used and not usually successful. I've also had the experience of seeing an individual who has not had access to opioid replacement therapy or been faithful with that and follow-up, who has overdosed subsequently and suffered some significant brain damage from lack of oxygen and has become subsequently profoundly compromised. Because they've survived and there's been lack of oxygen delivery to the brain. So this, to me, this bill is basically like giving a green light to someone that is around this individual, a family member, people that are going to be first responders will be able to have this, the patient themselves perhaps, or the individual themselves, who can be trained to literally save a life. The responses need to be rather rapid when people are unintentionally overdosing, and no addict that I know plans to overdose. Nobody, their plan is to get high and to feel good, to escape for a period of time. But it's not usually to die at all. And often what happens is that they may be off of their opiate for a while. They're incarcerated. They lose some tolerance. They're, say, in prison for 9 months, 10 months. Doesn't even have to be that long, but they lose their tolerance. They come out, and they think that they can go back to the same amount that they used before, and they overdose. And they're, and I've heard these stories repeatedly. Or they get a hold of a compound that has not been cut and is stronger than what they usually inject, and they have problems with this. They overdose. So these are, and many of our people that we're dealing with, these are young people that are doing this and that are dying. So access to this medication that's been out since 1971, used by professionals for a long, long time, is safe. This agent is a safe agent, easily used now. By nasal spray, by many of the law enforcement throughout the country are using it now. There's been a recent release of an auto-inject, sort of like your epinephrine pens or your EpiPens for bee allergies or peanut allergies, something similar. Very similar, easy to use, small amount delivered that's pre-measured that can be literally life-saving, allowing medical personnel to get there and then to carry on the treatment. So I would highly encourage this committee to approve this. The ASAM, or American Society of Addiction Medicine, actually published a public policy statement on this, saying many of the things that have been cited before, and I won't repeat, by the prior speaker. And I think that this rescue would serve our community and serve these people, giving them time to getting into treatment, giving them time to change behaviors. And I think it could be life-saving for many.
Okay.
Are there any questions that you may have?
No. Well, thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Next up, that's all that's in the off-net, and I don't think anybody signed up in the LIOs, so we'll bring it into the room. Kate Burkhart. Kate, you've been here before. You could, you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Kate Burkhart. I am the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Alaska Mental Health Board. I am offering the board's support and comments for SB 23, and my comments represent only the position of the board and no one else. I would like to echo the comments of the sponsor. We too have received public comment from both family members and physicians over the last about 18 months asking for guidance about how they can provide access to Narcan kits and naloxone to their patients. You heard Dr. Colescott speak about issues related to tolerance and overdose for folks who have been in prison or other situations where they might not be using at their normal capacity. One of the things that physicians engaged in addiction treatment and especially medication-assisted treatment for opiates have worries about is relapse. We know that people with serious substance use disorders often relapse in the course of treatment. And so these physicians who have someone under their care for addiction treatment seek to offer this protection against overdose in the case of relapse, but do not have express guidance from the state medical board and have concerns about liability. And so SB 23 provides specific policy guidance as well as protection to these physicians. Often the prescription is to the mother or the spouse or the partner or the family member and not to the actual person in treatment, but this provides a very important support to people in treatment for heroin and opiate addictions so that if relapse occurs, they are not prejudiced by the fact that they have achieved sobriety for a period of time. We very much appreciate what SB 23 does, and we are very much in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anybody's got any comments? Better come forward quick. You could introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
My name is Karen Nelson, and I represent the Juneau Recovery Community. I must have signed the wrong sheet. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So I'm also the director of Haven House Transitional Housing Opening for Women Coming Out of Prison, and I'm able to go into the prison as well and speak with a lot of women there as a peer because I am a person in long-term recovery. What that means is I haven't used a drink or a drug since June 1st of 2011. Prior to that, I spent a better part of 20 years in active addiction. I have OD'd myself twice, and I can tell you I was left at one point when I was 20 years old in Tacoma, Washington. Now, we didn't have Narcan at that time, but I mean, there's just such a slight moment where I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have my three beautiful children. I wouldn't be in our community right now serving other people doing this job as someone in recovery with a passion. I don't get paid to do this. You know, it's a volunteer thing because this is our life. We understand what long-term recovery means. This isn't short-term treatment cures, and that's a big part of it, but there's many pieces. Narcan saves lives, and I think all lives matter. I don't even know what the discussion would be about that, except that it's really, I know a family, a friend actually that goes to our church, and she just lost a nephew recently on an overdose, and it's just so, I've personally lost 9 friends to heroin and opioids. I've had many acquaintances die that I went to high school with, people I played basketball with. I was in college and high school. You know, there is, addiction does not discriminate. Recovery doesn't either. And so this is a community-wide effort, you know, of really educating on what does addiction really look like, you know, and what do felons and this criminalization really look like? I have 3 beautiful children. They had both their parents in prison because of drugs. And so, you know, they were also traumatized in that way. So that one life saved could really bring so much to everyone in a large way. One life saved, obviously, I mean, I couldn't even go on and on about the things that one person can do. But there are many people in recovery right here in Juneau in long-term recovery. And, you know, we love to share our gift with other people. And so I guess I just would like to say, you know, it does matter. I was left because no one wanted to go to jail for, you know, helping me out. And that experience when I heard the woman talking about her clients and how they described throwing people in the tub, I mean, this is real, you know, and we don't choose to do that. I didn't choose drugs over my children. Yes, I used, and then it became something that took over. I guarantee you I did not do that consciously. You know, I didn't choose that over my children. This is a public health issue, and we've been, you know, it's been said since, I think, the 50s, and we're still treating it as a moral issue and a criminal issue. And it's really, the impacts, the collateral consequences are so huge. They go all the way down. And with Haven House right now, you could go out there today, and you'll see a sign. Sorry, my mouth is so dry.
Some water right there.
I just welcomed our very first woman to Haven House after a year and a half of legal battles and a lot of hard times. But, you know, the beautiful thing is that we're going to be able to change that view and that perspective because there's still a sign right in front of our house that says, good idea, wrong place. Or I've seen it so many times I don't even notice it anymore. But, you know, she had to walk into that. And I know the fears are legitimate. I get that. And so it's really up to us to really educate. And Narcan is one thing we would want to be trained in, and I would be more than happy to do the training. I would totally take that on, and so would the recovery community. Whether we, you know, have a center or not, we will do that on our own. I mean, we will do it either way. People are going to be recovering, and we're going to be moving forward and doing this thing. But it'd be awesome to really have people really understand what that means, and long-term recovery is... Yeah, let's just do it. You know, where our state is dying. So.
I can't remember if you put your name on the record. Could you do it again?
Kara Nelson. Okay, K-A-R-A.
Couldn't remember when you first started. Normally, try to pay attention to those things.
I don't know either.
Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony today. I see no one else coming forward. Nobody else signed into the LIOs calling, so we're going to go ahead and close public hearing, come back to the committee. We have any comments, questions of the bill sponsor before we set this aside? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm very comforted to see some of the people supporting this, the Mental Health Trust and the State Medical Association. I would like to, before we leave these deliberations, whatever day we bring it up again, I'd like to have our, we are addressing this as a public health issue, but I want to make sure we hear from our criminal division as well. I like the idea of, first I like the idea of Senator Ellis pushing a tort reform bill, and that really excites me. But in removing the barriers of a legion of lawyers between a first responder and the administering life-saving procedures, but I just want to make sure that we don't indemnify. I can see scenarios, and we see in our communities and our crestdowns, a 16-year-old girl, which is not an uncommon in a shooting gallery with adults, and them being pardoned from the gross negligence or recklessness because they cause the problem and then administer the cure, and still the accompanying problems in that part. I'd like to hear first from before we send the bill on to other deliberations that from our Department of Law, and I've noticed during this new administration there's a little bit of stifling of some of the criminal discussions on other drug issues, and I'd sure like to make sure that's part of it, just so we give us general assurances that we're not taking a bigger leap than we may think we are. And I know I've had a lot of problems getting criminal attorneys to be allowed to come to committee, and I know you're assertive enough, Mr. Chair, that you can drag it out of them. Just on the record, so we get that on the record that it isn't a serious, and it probably isn't, but I just want to have that assurance and not have to be discussing this on the floor. And even on our, just a little more, and the sponsor is great to work with, and his staff, very professional, and I know they'll discuss with me, and in our time we have outside of committee, and then we can put on the record whatever the response or assurances are. But those are the only issues I have.
Okay. Any other questions for the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside? Any final comments from the bill sponsor?
Just thank you.
Okay. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, Senate Bill 55 by Senator Geisel. Do you want to do it from here or out
yes.
there?
Okay. From here would be fine.
Okay,
and
we can have Senator Geisel's Lifeline staff come forward, please. Might as well. Senator Geisel, what do we have for the committee today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Geisel. I represent Senate District N. Senate Bill 55 modernizes and updates the Alaska optometry statutes. These statutes are approximately 40 years old, Mr. Chairman. Continuing education is required, but in this bill, the hours and subjects will be determined by the Board of Optometry, just like it's done by other professional boards. In fact, currently, the regulations in place by the Board of Optometry require more continuing education for optometrists than the statutory requirement. So that subsection is being deleted from the bill. We need to get this statute cleaned up and current with the times and modern scope of practice. SB 55 also allows the board to determine prescribed drug schedules, anticipating that federal regulations may change. Now, you may remember in 2014, last year, Mr. Chairman, we passed a bill that allowed the prescribing of hydrocodone. Should it become a Class 2 designation by the Federal Drug Administration. It allowed for only 4 days of prescribing of Vicodin by an optometrist. All this time, hydrocodone has been a Category 3 drug, which optometry was authorized to prescribe, but the federal government was indicating they may be moving it to a Category 2. So we made that provision last year. This bill updates the optometry definition to reflect current education and training and, let me be clear about this, specifically prohibits invasive surgery. I'll repeat that just so that you do hear it. It specifically prohibits invasive surgery by optometrists. It allows for future new and improved diagnostic and therapeutic procedures by the board. It defines optometrists as qualified for any procedure that they are educated and trained to perform. You're going to read letters in the packet that the bill would allow optometrists to perform surgery around or on the eye. And this is simply not true. It is not part of the bill. Alaska optometrists already do superficial surgical procedures such as the removal of a corneal foreign body under current statute, but nothing more invasive is permitted by the bill. Vast majority of Alaskans visit an optometrist for their health care. A level of entry to the healthcare system for a vast majority of Alaskans. In fact, nationally, 75% of citizens see an optometrist first. Optometrists typically will by profession, refer on more complicated issues, such as retinal issues, glaucoma, and other diseases to an ophthalmologist who are more qualified to take care of more complex issues. So, Mr. Chairman, the bill is brief. It is simply updating scope of practice and statutes pertaining to optometry. So if it is your pleasure, my able staff, Jane Conway, can take you through a sectional analysis of the bill. Thank you.
Conway.
Mr. Chairman.
Before we go to the
Senator Stoltz. Question of the medical professional. On that, Senator Giesel referred to invasive surgery. Is there any ocular surgery that isn't invasive, or is that a redundant?
There are things that are not invasive. I mentioned the corneal foreign body. Okay. So this is can be an emergency, particularly if it's a piece of metal, chair, Senator Stoltz, as it can actually discolor the cornea permanently. So you want that taken out immediately. An optometrist is capable of doing that and frankly has the technical equipment to be able to visualize where the foreign body is and actually remove it.
Okay. Thank you. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and walk us through the bill, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Jane Conway, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. We're going to do a quick sectional of the bill. Section 1 requires the Board of Examiners in Optometry to adopt regulations governing prescription and use of pharmaceutical agents. This updates the old statute from the time before when there were not prescribing drugs. Section 2 amends AS 0872-181D by removing specified hours and period of continuing education requirements for the renewal of an optometrist's license, but retains delegation of those requirements to the board. Right now, 36 hours of continuing education are required every 2 years, and that is much more continuing education requirements than is right now in the statute. So that is why the removal of the language. Section 3 repeals and reenacts AS 0872272A to provide that pharmaceutical agents, including controlled substances, may be used by a licensed optometrist if consistent with standards adopted by the board and any limitations on practice under Section 5 of the bill. Section 4 reenacts and modifies the prohibition of a licensee to perform an intravitreal injection, which is an injection into the globe of the eyeball. Section 5 provides that a licensee may perform only services within the licensee's training and experience as provided by the board regulations. Section 6 revises the definition of optometry. The current definition is decades old. Section 7 adds a definition of invasive surgery to the bill. That concludes the sectional.
On the change of definition, what was the change?
Through the chair, could you point out where you're asking me the question and which section?
Line 23, page 2, section 6. Repealed and reenacted, but what's the difference between the two, the old and the new? Well, you can get back to the committee if you want.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. Get back. Any initial questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Stoltz?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. She grabs her statute. I wanted to ask our healthcare professional, describe what the difference between an OD is, how my optometrist, that's what I see on his billings, and the MD, and that would be helpful for our deliberations and probably for the public as well.
Senator Giesel, you want to help Senator Stoltz with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stoltz, through the chair, I will endeavor to give you an off-the-cuff definition here.
Just for those.
But we have some folks, of course, who wish to testify who could probably speak more. So a doctor of optometry is an extensive degree, and I'm going to let them talk about how long it is. A doctor of ophthalmology is actually a medical physician who has had specialized training in surgery, particularly surgery of the eye, and more complex invasive procedures. My optometrist does basic eye exams. She also does diagnostic procedures to identify retinal problems, glaucoma, so diagnostic type things, and some treatment of those things, but not invasive surgery.
And there'll be future folks testifying that you can direct those questions to from their specific field.
Actually, I thought I'd have the referee here do it because they're each going to describe themselves. And
okay.
Thanks.
So, do we have any other initial questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing. We'll start with the off-net. I'm just going to go down through the list. There's four, just so everybody can kind of know the amount. And there's looks like there's probably three to possibly four in the room. I'd like to go ahead and start. When you start your testimony, state who you are, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please. Senate Bill 55. We'll start with Rachel Reinhart from Seattle. If you can introduce yourself and testify, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Stedman and Vice Chair Giesel and members of the committee. Am I being heard?
Yes.
Yes, fantastic. My name is Dr. Rachel Reinhart, MD. I'm a board-certified ophthalmologist from the Seattle, Washington area, and I've been in private practice for about 11 years. I earned my MD from the University of Washington as well as completed my ophthalmology residency at the University of Washington, a total of 8 years post-college. I'm honored to testify today on behalf of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, representing over 31,000 ophthalmologists worldwide, and asking for your opposition to Senate Bill 55. This legislation would permit optometrists who are non-medical doctors and who have not completed medical school nor surgical residency to perform surgery on and around the eye. This bill would allow Alaska's optometry board to set its own educational and licensure requirements and remove the Alaska State Medical Board as the governing body. As an MD, I am policed by the Board of Medicine, but Senate Bill 55 would mean that optometrists doing eye surgery would not be. This alone is grounds for rejecting this legislation. Our biggest concern, however, is that Senate Bill 55 and how it relates to eye surgeries. And yes, it is a concern for us. Senate Bill 55 states that optometrists cannot perform, quote, invasive surgery, end quote. And they provide a short list of surgeries that are prohibited. And at first glance, you may think that this sounds as if optometrists will be prevented from doing eye surgery, but the language is actually grossly misleading. And in fact, the language would actually allow optometrists to do any surgical procedure not listed on their short list as long as it meets their arbitrary definition of invasive surgery. And they define that as, quote, penetration through the globe of the eye. Well, there are hundreds, just to answer a question from a senator earlier, there are hundreds of ocular and lid surgeries that are not considered, quote, penetration through the globe that optometrists could do. And for instance, even though on their short list they say corneal transplantation is prohibited, there's a multitude of partial thickness corneal surgeries, including lamellar keratoplasties, pterygium excisions where you're excising membranes from the surface of the eye and using a drill to sand down the surface and harvesting conjunctiva to suture that onto the surgical site. The bill also states that they cannot do cosmetic lid surgery. There are dozens and dozens of orbital and eyelid surgeries that are not cosmetic, and they don't, quote, penetrate the globe. Examples: ptosis repair, entropion repair, punctoplasty, blepharoplasty, Chalazian incision and curettage, excisions of even malignant tumors of the lid and orbit, even the lacrimal gland. So it definitely, there are scores of them. Along the same lines, the bill states that they cannot do, quote, refractive surgery, but they have defined as only representing two types of refractive surgery, LASIK and PRK specifically. The problem is there are at least eight other refractive surgeries, some with lasers, some with scalpels, that they would be able to do based on the definitions they provide. LASIK is an example, conductive keratoplasty in which you burn the cornea to change the shape, and even limbal relaxing incisions where you go so far as to make a 90% cut in the cornea to reduce astigmatism, and that does not, quote, penetrate the globe. This bill would also not prohibit optometrists from using laser surgeries. Lasers are surgical instruments. They cut as deeply and sharply as any scalpel. This bill would allow them to perform dozens of laser surgeries for very serious eye diseases, laser peripheral iridotomy, selective laser trabeculoplasty, examples of glaucoma lasers, a YAG capsulotomy, and so on. This would also remove the existing safeguard against injections in and around the eye. Even though Senate Bill 55 arbitrarily prohibits performing one type of an injection, which they list as intravitreal injection, which is in the back of the eye, there are dozens of other injections into other parts of the eye, including the front part of the eye wall, eyelids, eye muscles, and even orbit. So you will definitely probably hear testimony that says this is not the intention of the bill for optometrists to do surgery, but it is very, very important to understand that this bill creates massive loopholes that would make it impossible to stop them from doing these surgeries should they decide to do it. The bottom line, there is no such thing as a non-invasive surgery, and there are no shortcuts to learning how to safely perform surgery. Expertise in performing these surgeries and managing serious systemic complications that may be associated with them is achieved through 4 years of medical school and at least 4 years of surgical residency. That totals over 17,000 hours of direct medical surgical training. It cannot be obtained in an 8 hours of a special add-on course. My final point that I'll make, and this is very apropos listening to Senate Bill 23 testimony, is that this bill would lift restrictions on optometrists to prescribe restricted medications. Last year, before this very committee, you heard optometrists testify to you saying that in order to protect the patients of Alaska, that their narcotic prescriptions, namely Vicodin, for instance, would be limited to a four-day supply and that they cannot prescribe any other Schedule II narcotics. Not 1 year later, this Senate Bill 55 would remove that four-day restriction on hydrocodone narcotics, and it would expand optometry's authority to prescribe all Schedule 1A and 2A controlled substances without limitations. Not even all MDs in my state, for instance, have the authority to do that. And with prescription narcotic deaths, now the number one cause of accidental death in the United States, this is absolutely reason alone to reject this Senate bill. So in conclusion, the American Academy of Ophthalmology considers patient safety paramount. It is our duty, both as ophthalmologists and legislators, to do everything we can to protect our patients. Only three states in the entire country have enacted legislation as radical as Senate Bill 55. It is not merely an update of old statutes. Alaskans deserve to keep your state's high standards of surgical safety. And once again, I respectfully ask that you vote no on Senate Bill 55. I'm very much grateful for this opportunity to testify. And I can answer the question about the difference between ODs and MDs, and I'll let the ODs speak for themselves as well. Medical doctor, ophthalmologists are medical doctors. We're MDs, so after 4 years of college, we have 4 years of medical school, and we learn about the whole human body first in all organ systems, neurosurgery, vascular surgery, urology, pediatrics, family medicine, everything. And when we graduate medical school, we become MDs, and we're trained in the body as a whole. So we're doctors of the body first. Then you pick your specialty of training. It just so happens that that I've picked ophthalmology, but you could do family medicine, neurosurgery, and so forth. So that surgical residency is 4 years, and that includes the first year of an internship. So that is a 100% medical surgical training for 8 years that totals over 17,000 hours of direct medical and patient surgical care. So hopefully that helps answer that question. And I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Ben, right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up,
I do have a question. So thank you for your testimony. Have you ever practiced in Alaska?
I have not.
And second question, how many ophthalmologists are there in Alaska licensed?
There are 27.
27. Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I checked the number of optometry licenses in Alaska. There are 179. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Optometry, there's over 100. Ophthalmology, there's about 27.
Okay. Thank you.
And I can also check
right.
that, too. If
That's fine. Next up, Jeff Gonison from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Gonison. I represent the Alaska Optometric Association. I was born and raised in Ketchikan. I was the first Alaska native to be licensed as a doctor of optometry in Alaska. I am a former chair of the State Optometry Board, and I served twice under two different governors. I'm currently in private practice in Anchorage, and I also sit on the board of Cook Inlet Region, Inc., also known as CIRI. Some brief history. In 1988, Alaska finally became the very last legislature in the nation to authorize optometrists to use simple dilating and numbing drops because of opposition. In 1992, Alaska became the 32nd state to allow us to prescribe topical therapeutic drugs. In the 2000 session, a bill was passed by both bodies, 58-2, to allow us to additionally prescribe oral medications and injections, but Tony Knowles vetoed it, taking another 7 years to get it up and signed into law, which we currently have. For 40 years, organized ophthalmology has opposed any legislation that we've introduced, often pulling in their medical association brotherhood and claiming great public harm and jeopardy. Yet the 40-year record shows that none of this is true. I don't believe there's ever been a single complaint to the board involving inappropriate care by optometry. Our malpractice insurance is about $500 a year. We were the only eye care providers in the vast majority of Alaska communities, some even 1,000 miles away from urban centers. There are 12 medical doctors in my Anchorage building, and they rely on me to treat anything worse than pink eye, or I will refer to ophthalmology if needed. Our optometry schools are fully accredited, and there are optometry students in the same classes with medical and dental students at some of these universities. Many optometrists take additional residency training at VA hospitals and other famous eye hospitals like Bascom-Palmer. In this modern day, we work closely with our ophthalmology colleagues in the best interest of our patients. We refer to these specialists for surgical treatment and often co-manage the surgical follow-up care in a modern teamwork model. The same as family doctors refer to specialists. Family MDs have no restrictions, but they use their professional judgment on what they can do, and optometrists do the same as when to refer. SB 55 modernizes the statutes, puts many of the small details into regulation to be determined by the board, as has been done for many years by the other learned professions. Optometry is an independent profession. We've never been under the medical board. We are the family eye doctors. We're not trying to be ophthalmologists, only to perform within our scope of training. Now, the board will certainly not allow Alaska licensees to perform any treatment or procedure that would be outside our scope of practice. Section 5 of this bill specifically legislates limitations on practice and prohibits invasive surgery. And the most important point is that Alaska optometrists are held to the same high standard of care as all other medical professionals in any treatment they provide. In respect to the chair, we have only invited our four testifiers, even though there are over 160 of us around Alaska. I've personally been through almost every hearing on this for over 30 years, and Dr. Barney and I are available for further questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Scott Lindstrom from Anchorage.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to testify, Chairman. My name is Scott Lindstrom. I'm an ophthalmologist that practices in Anchorage. I specialize in vitreoretinal surgery. I've been in Alaska for 19 years. With regards to the question regarding what's involved in training, I'll reiterate what Dr. Reinhart discussed. I completed a four-year college degree, 4 years of medical school, 1 year of internship, 3 years of clinical and surgical residency, and a one-year fellowship in retinal surgery, totaling 13 years of my life. I was 31 years old by the time I finished my training. That training was very intensive and highly supervised, and I became a qualified a surgeon to perform very delicate laser and invasive surgery of the eye. Main concern that I don't want to reiterate what was testified before with Dr. Reinhart, that the main concern is that this bill really is misleading, and it allows optometrists to perform multiple laser procedures on the eye in addition to other surgical procedures. I'll give you a brief clinical story of within the past year, I've had to remove two eyes of patients that had had steroid injections to the eye. Both patients have been thought to have inflammatory disease of the eye. One was given a subpenons Kenalog injection to the eye to treat what was thought to be inflammatory disease of the eye. This was not performed by an optometrist, but was performed by a medical doctor. A patient didn't have inflammatory disease but had an infection in the eye. And within a day, the infection became uncontrollable and was untreatable, and the patient had to have the eye removed. A few weeks ago, I removed another patient's eye who was thought to have inflammation in the eye and was given an intraocular injection of a steroid. This bill does prohibit that from optometrists. This injection was, again, given by another medical doctor. This patient didn't have inflammatory disease of the eye, but had a fungal infection of the eye. The fungal infection became uncontrollable, operated on him four times, and eventually had to remove the eye to prevent the fungus from spreading to his brain. My point is that these procedures are very serious procedures, and they can lead to not only blindness, the fungal infection in the brain could possibly lead to death. The bill as written, and I believe the optometrists actually have the ability to inject steroids around the eye and up, but not into the eye. So there are very serious consequences of allowing these procedures to be performed. It's important that the people performing these procedures have the extensive training and background to be able to identify the possible risks and appropriately treat the patients. Regarding one other point I wanted to make is this bill does allow, would allow optometrists to perform laser procedures such as YAG capsulotomy, laser iridotomy, which are, quote, non-invasive procedures, but the laser does penetrate into the eye, and I believe the bill would also allow them to perform retinal laser, which is my specialty. These are not minor procedures. The complication of one laser burn in the wrong part of the eye, the fovea, can lead to permanent blindness of the eye. It's very important that the people performing these procedures have the proper education and training to do them. The last point I'd like to make is that the Alaska State Medical Association, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the Alaska Academy of Eye Physicians and Surgeons, and the Independent Practice Association, Interior Independent Practice Association, have all come out in opposition to this bill. This is a difficult thing for me to testify to because being a retinal specialist in the state of Alaska, I speak to a dozen optometrists a day, at least in referral. I consider many of them my friends, and we do manage patients together. I think that we all have limitations in our education, and we need to steer our scope of practice to what our education allows us to do. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Here we have a question from Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, I was on the anecdotes you gave about the two, however described, mistreatments or inappropriate, whatever the correct terminology is, they were, you described medical activities by a, or I guess procedures by a medical doctor.
Yes.
Is your concern about, and I'm trying to figure out what, and you offered those anecdotes, I assume for a reason, is it that this should, optometrists would be limited, or all medical doctors that aren't specialists in ophthalmology should be limited? I wasn't, were you trying to get us to a nexus of a conclusion, or would given
my,
two?
My main point was that the first patient I discussed had an injection to the outside of the eye. This was not a penetration of the eye and was given a steroid injection, which this bill allows, and I believe that actually optometry currently has the ability to do this. I'm not 100% sure of that. The point is that these procedures require very careful analysis of the patient, and if you don't have the background and the extensive training and you perform this procedure, this could be the possible result. And my personal feeling is that if you're going to be injecting steroids around the eye for uveitis, which is inflammation in the eye, it probably ought to be done by a retinal specialist, which is what I am, because I see the complications and the bad outcomes that come from these procedures. And there's no doubt that this current bill, SB 55, would allow an injection of a steroid to the external part of the eye. Again, I can't speak of details, but I just use this as an example, and these were not performed by optometrists.
Okay. So, you have a follow-up?
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So I'm trying to understand this, and that's why I'd ask the questions about MDs and ODs. Absent this proposed statute, and let's just take optometrists off the table, is any medical doctor under current state law allowed to perform these types of retinal procedures? Is there a limit within within either statute or I guess through regulation? And that's a curiosity I have. Or is there a need? Is it anybody that's not an ophthalmologist? And I'm just jumping back at the examples given; those were MDs and the Medical Association has always been on this issue. I'm trying to grasp this. You think after 30 years of watching this,
let him answer the question.
Yeah, I will, sir.
Mr. Lindstrom or Dr. Lindstrom.
Yes. Yes. Medical doctors go through the process. Once you've finished all of your training, then you enter private practice and you undergo board certification and whatnot to specialize. You basically limit your practice to your specialty. When I do perform surgery in the hospital, I apply for hospital privileges. I have a list of procedures that I've done thousands of, and the hospital reviews the list and says, yes, you're qualified to do vitreoretinal surgery, you're qualified to do, you know, corneal transplant, depending on what your specialty is. Most of these procedures are performed in the hospital, and they're very tightly regulated. I couldn't walk into the hospital and perform brain surgery on somebody because I'm a ophthalmologist who specializes in vitreoretinal surgery. What would limit somebody from doing these procedures in their own practice, like a family doctor deciding to give a steroid injection to someone's eye? I'm not aware of the regulations regarding that, but in hospitals and in the general practice of medicine, we don't perform the surgeries that we're not highly qualified for and have been undergone, you know, rigorous examination of what we do.
Mr. Sherman, we almost got there. I want to know, is there a legal prohibition? That's the part, what practices are by individual hospitals. As we're dealing with a statute here, I don't know if we got a clear answer to that.
We can work on that going forward. Senator Kelly.
Sorry, I got an answer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Giesel.
I do have an answer for Senator Stoltz's question, if you would permit it.
Go ahead.
The medical statutes do not limit, in general, the practice of physicians to specific specialties. What the ophthalmologist described to you was hospital privileges, the situations where the inappropriate diagnosis was made in an outpatient setting, and physicians are not limited in any way.
That's real helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Lindstrom? Move on to Paul Barney. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please, and try to keep your comments a little bit concise. We want to get everybody on testimony on board before we run out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Barney. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an optometrist and the current chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Optometric Association. For the past 15 years, I've been the clinical director of Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute in Anchorage. Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute, also known as PCLI, is a referral center limited to medical and surgical eye care. As an optometrist with PCLI, my practice is entirely devoted to medical eye care and pre- and post-surgical eye care. I work with an ophthalmic surgeon and a certified registered nurse anesthetist, and together we provide quality, affordable surgical care to Alaskans. In fact, we are the largest provider of cataract care in the state of Alaska. PCLI's approach to eye care is to work collaboratively as a team and to optimize each practitioner's training skills. To that end, I perform the pre-surgical examination, preoperative counseling, and postoperative care. Our nurse anesthetist administers the anesthetic injections for surgery and manages the patient's response to the anesthesia. Our surgeon performs the cataract surgery. And although I've lived and practiced in Alaska for 15 years, I practiced in this capacity for 30 years. You'll hear arguments against SB 55 both from organized ophthalmology and individual ophthalmologists. The arguments will be exclusionary and will state that only an ophthalmologist is trained medically and only an ophthalmologist is capable of performing the very tasks that the nurse anesthetist and I do on a daily basis and have done for years. You also hear opposition that this bill will allow injections into the globe and will allow optometrists to do surgery. The bill specifically prohibits both of those. What the bill does do, it allows the Board of Examiners in Optometry to determine the details of practice of optometry. But you'll hear arguments that the Board of Optometry can't be trusted to establish and enforce those regulations. As chairman of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry, I can assure you that the primary concern of the Board of Optometry is the safety of the public. In the 4 years that I've served on the board, we've had no complaints from the public that were serious enough to even consider disciplinary action. I doubt there are many other healthcare professions in Alaska that can claim the same track record. In general, optometrists are conservative and cautious practitioners, and the passage of SB 55 would not change their conservative nature. Senate Bill 55 would be good for the state of Alaska. The bill puts the regulatory details to the practice of optometry in the authority of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry. This is similar to how dentistry, nurse practitioners, and medicine are regulated. SB 55 also modernizes the definition of optometry to reflect what's currently taught at colleges and schools of optometry in the U.S. It would allow the Alaska Board to determine the details of pharmaceutical prescribing. These changes are important to allow the profession and practice of optometry to incorporate new technologies and advances in eye care as they occur. The current statutes concerning optometry require the profession to come to the legislature for approval each time new advances occur. As has already been stated, optometry provides approximately 70% of the eye care in the U.S. In some rural areas, especially in Alaska, optometrists are the only eye care provider in the community. The citizens of Alaska deserve to be served by a profession that is allowed to stay current with advances in new technology in eye care. With that said, I'd respectfully urge you to support SB 55, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the off-net. We're going to come now into the room. We've got three testifiers in about 15 minutes, so it looks like we'll be right on time. We'll just, again, go right down the list. We'll start with Jill Mattson. If she can come forward, please. Messerschmidt will be next, and I'm not quite sure the name of the last one, Kara Nelson or somebody, whoever signed up last. I can't read it. But if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Recovery House.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. Well, we got two in 15 minutes, so you got a full 5 minutes like everybody else. So.
Good afternoon, Chairman Stedman and the rest of the committee. I'm Dr. Jill Mattson, an optometrist here in Juneau, and I am here to support Senate Bill 55. I've been in practice for 23 years, and during that time, I have served two terms on the State of Alaska Board of Examiners, one term as chair. I have also testified for four different optometry bills over my 23 years. And every time I have testified, you legislators and I have heard the same opposition, that we aren't trained, the public's at risk, we aren't capable to treat patients at the level we were requesting. During all of those times, you guys sifted through all the testimony and data and trusted the information that we as optometrists had put forth to you. And you pass bills that now enable optometrists to do all the things that we do. The passage of these bills over the years has enabled us to treat our patients promptly, safely, and effectively. And as it's been stated, we have a great track record. During my time on the board, we didn't have any open cases of optometrists being investigated for harming a patient. We are a safe profession, and we can govern ourselves. The risk is low. We also talked about someone else testified about low malpractice rates in the state being around $500 a year. So what we told you and what we told you is true. We are not going to harm our patients. So now the time has come for us to ask that you further put your trust in optometry by allowing Optometry Board to regulate our profession. That really is what Senate Bill 55 does. It puts the continuing education requirements back into regulation, and it modernizes definitions of the optometry and invasive surgery for optometrists. Some of the restrictions are already performed by optometrists in some states, but our conservative nature feels that these would not be things that a primary care optometrists would need to do. So while the board would be confined to these definitions and restrictions of the bill, I still feel it allows the board enough room to update the regulations down the road to coincide with advancements in the field for the foreseeable future. So yes, this would be new ground for optometrists to regulate ourselves. But it is not new ground for the state in that both nurse practitioners and dentists are now self-regulated. So the bill allows the optometry board to react via the regulatory process to changes its technology as advances. That's really the point. So while we are not asking for specific expansion of practice at this time, it does open the door for expansion in the future. And that's what we are all called to do as professionals, practice at the highest level of our training. And I feel that is protection of the public, because it ensures that optometrists, who are the first line of eye care in nearly every community in this state, can treat Alaskans with the most modern methods at our disposal. So how optometry will change over the years is yet to be determined, but what we do know is that how any healthcare professional practices is constantly changing. We are constantly learning new techniques and treatments to help our patients, and this bill puts the responsibility of that regulation, of those regulations, with the board members. And those board members are still members, are still optometrists and one member of the public, who are appointed by the legislature and the governor. So there will still be a check and balance, as the legislators will still have to approve those members. All of the board members I had served with over my 8 years were conscientious, intelligent, and understood the gravity of the decisions that they made. The last point I'd like to make is that our opposition has stated that we would be lowering the surgical standard. Again, this isn't true. We currently are, as is any healthcare professional, held to the same level of care for any given procedure, whether it be surgery or any procedure. We don't take that lightly. The optometry board is and always has been very conservative, and I trust that they would not allow optometrists to do anything without proper training. And then I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. The optometry board is not currently under the medical board. I'm not sure if that's the case in Washington, but in Alaska we are our own board, and we also already do have authority for injections around the eye. So it is my hope that you will once again put your trust in optometry and vote in favor of Senate Bill 55. And I really thank you for your time, and thank you for all your service to this state over the years.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, Ms. Schmidt. He's the last on the list. We have about 11 minutes, so everybody should have 5 minutes. Normally we have about 2.5 minutes on these testimony, but just worked out today with the amount of people signed up and the subject matter that, so if you keep up with all your colleagues, you'll be right at about 5 minutes.
It won't take long. Please forgive me if I miss the protocol here, Mr. Chairman. My name is Forrest Messerschmidt. I'm fourth generation Alaskan, practiced 26 years in Juneau, currently serving my third year on the Alaska State Board of Optometry. A lot of this you've heard before, but I'm going to repeat some of it again. I believe Senate Bill is good legislation that puts regulatory power where it belongs with the State Board of Optometry, modernizes the statutes, allows details of regulation to be determined by the board, very similar to standards for dentistry, nurse practitioners, and medicine. Alaskan optometrists should be held to the same high standard of care as other medical professionals and in the treatment they provide. It's ridiculous to suggest that other professions can regulate their own and we can't. That just doesn't make sense. Over my 26 years of practice, I can tell you that much has changed in eye care. More than 50% of my practice is medical care. Probably zero of it was when I first started practicing. I routinely diagnose and manage complex eye diseases, diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and many others. Those are probably the big three. All of these relationships as optometrists involve relationships with surgeons that are based on mutual trust in the competency of care. Much of what we do now was not allowed a few short years ago because of outdated limitations imposed by slow adaptation of state law in relation to skills and training. Conditions that used to require expensive travel to Seattle or Anchorage are now managed competently and effectively with reduced travel or no travel at all for patients. You'll hear others cry wolf about patient harm that will occur once again if an optometry bill is passed, when they know for the past 40 years that optometry scope expansion law, that this is not the case. They miss the point of why this bill is important. When an 80-year-old patient with diabetic macular edema and failing vision elects not to travel for an effective sight-preserving procedure, it pains me. That happened just yesterday. I know 20 years from now, much more skilled optometric physicians than I will be able to offer some new, simpler procedure locally to manage that patient's condition and save their sight. It's simple math. No matter how you look at it, there are not enough skilled ophthalmologists to serve our rapidly aging population. As skills and training expand, we need all eye care physicians to be able to practice to their full level of expertise. As a board member, I can tell you that nothing is more important than protection of the public. I don't foresee any dramatic change in how we practice in Alaska with the passage of this bill. We'll continue to provide quality care, protect our patients' well-being as if they were our own. I do foresee a streamlining of the legislative process to take on more pressing issues regarding the state of Alaska. Optometry is well-trained, highly skilled profession that provides a majority of first-line eye care in Alaska. As our education and professional standards evolve, we should be able to practice to the highest level of care consistent with our training and education. Optometry has always been a cautious profession and will continue to be so in the future. I have no doubt that the board, we as the board, are fully capable of providing oversight and maintaining standards needed to safeguard the public. SB 55 is good for optometry. It removes a recurring burden for precious legislative time, and most importantly, it's good for Alaska. I respectfully urge your support for Senate Bill 55. Thank you.
Thank you. We have any questions? Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Dr. Messerschmidt, how many ophthalmologists are there in Juneau?
One.
Thank you. So if this, follow up please. Sure. If this individual goes on vacation, there are none. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are none.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That, thank you.
And in Sitka, there's probably zero?
Sitka, there are some that travel through, through search and other positions, but they're not there on a regular basis.
Senator Keller.
You're on the board of optometry?
Yes.
State board? Were you confirmed by the legislature?
I have no idea.
I think you were.
You were.
You were.
It's been an easy question. Apparently no controversy.
Yeah, I remember your name. I can't remember what year it was. But.
Yeah, I remember his name. Another question is, that, or not a question, but a comment, and that is to the people who are from, who are opposing this bill from the ophthalmology community. Here's what I need, and that is this. The bill says that you shan't do surgery. And Senator Giesel, who is a medical professional and we trust her a lot, says that the bill doesn't allow you to do invasive surgery. So score one for Senator Giesel, but I'm open-minded. Mm-hmm. Prove to me why she's wrong, why the plain reading of this bill is wrong. Not you, but the ophthalmology community. Second of all, the injections. It says there shall not be these kinds of injections. And I can see where there might be some debate over the kind of injection, that maybe the provisions of the bill might be too specific. But again, Senator Giesel says that injections into the globe of the eye are not allowed in this bill. Then I'm going to believe her until you prove otherwise. So ophthalmology community, I don't want a meeting. I don't want a bunch of people in my office and trying to convince me of anything. Give me a white paper, three paragraphs maximum, that says why what she said is wrong. Then I might vote with you. But until then, Senator Giesel gets the benefit of the doubt, and so does a plain reading of the bill.
Notice he didn't say how long the paragraphs were, just three paragraphs. We have any other questions for Dr. Messerschmidt before we... And Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. Not necessarily, Mr. Chairman, to be answered right now, but things I'd request from the optometric professional community is maybe some schematics on the apportionment or malapportionment of where these professionals are located. That might give us a clearer idea geographically. And I'd also I think it's on the burden for the optometric community to provide us with some assurances that the insurance providers don't have objections to this, or there's not wrinkles that we don't know about.
Dr. Messerschmidt, I don't think you can jump out of the hot seat if you want. It sounds like this is just going.
Thank you.
In wrap up. Have any other final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing no final questions for the bill sponsor, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. There'll be no meeting scheduled Friday. We will have a meeting Monday. I have to have a conversation with Senator Kelly, and if he is ready with his bill, we will schedule Medicaid Monday, and we'll start that process looking at cost containment. We are adjourned.